From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have the ability to take him out, and I think the time has come that we exercise that ability. We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-arm dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Pat Robertson has a history stretching back into the early 80s of preaching what can only be defined as sedition. That is, the complete dismantling of the democratic state and the replacement of a theocratic autocracy run by radical religious conservatives.
Today, we look at Pat Robertson's history and the implications of his call for the assassination of a foreign president.
It'll be interesting to see the reaction in this country to Robertson's call for the assassination of Chavez. Just imagine what would happen had a Muslim cleric called for the assassination of Tony Blair.
Today, Chris Hedges and Michael Ratner. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has dismissed the ongoing anti-war vigil in Crawford, Texas, initiated by Cindy Sheehan. He claims she was advocating a policy that would weaken the country.
I think those who advocate immediate withdrawal or from not only Iraq but the Middle East are advocating a policy that would weaken the United States. So I appreciate her right to protest. I understand her anguish. I met with a lot of families. She doesn't represent the view of a lot of the families I have met with, and I'll continue to meet with families.
President Bush's comments came during a last-minute trip to the Idaho resort town of Donnelly. The trip was scheduled after hundreds of military families, veterans, and anti-war protesters began camping outside his 1,600-acre estate in Crawford, Texas. In Idaho, Bush is staying at Tamarack Resort, known for its world-class ski mountain, its professional golf course, and the beautiful Lake Cascade. Meanwhile, anti-war protesters met Bush in Idaho. Even though the tiny town of Donnelly only has a population of 130, some 200 protesters took to the streets Monday night. Protests were also held in Boise. There were reports protesters planned to issue a citizen's arrest warrant for the president. Laura McCarthy, whose son is in Iraq, said at a rally, quote, "President Bush probably breathed a sigh of relief when he landed in Idaho last night, but no matter where he goes, he's going to find a Cindy Sheehan in every community across the United States. The name is going to be different, but the message is going to be the same," she said. Meanwhile, in Boise, the CBS and Fox affiliates are refusing to run an ad featuring Sheehan. An official at CBS's KBCI said, quote, "Sheehan accuses the president of the United States of being a liar. She claims the president lied about, among other things, the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There's no proof that we are aware of regarding the truthfulness of her claim." Earlier in the week, the ABC affiliate in Salt Lake City refused to run the same ad, claiming it could, quote, be offensive to our community in Utah. Meanwhile, the Bush administration appears to have launched a coordinated effort to discredit the anti-war movement. On Tuesday, President Bush, White House spokesperson Trent Duffy, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld all took jabs at critics of the war. Duffy described the critics as people who don't believe the U.S. must win the war on terror. Rumsfeld compared anti-war activists to American supporters of Joseph Stalin. He said, quote, "Throughout history, there have always been those who predict America's failure just around every corner. Many Western intellectuals praise Stalin. For a time, communism was very much en vogue. Thankfully, the American people are better centered. They ultimately come to the right decisions on big issues, and the future of Iraq is a very big issue," Rumsfeld said. Meanwhile, opinion polls show President Bush's approval rating has dropped to a new low of just 36%. This, according to the latest survey of the American Research Group. Bush's approval rating is now lower than Richard Nixon's was at the height of the Watergate scandal. In Iraq, the country's deputy justice minister has survived two assassination attempts over the past 24 hours. Earlier this morning, gunmen ambushed Bosho Ibrahim's convoy in Baghdad. Four of his bodyguards died in the ambush. His convoy also came under attack on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a suicide bomber killed 10 people at a joint U.S.-Iraqi base in the town of Bakuba. 8 policemen died in the explosion, along with a U.S. soldier and a contractor. American soldiers responded to the attack by accidentally killing 3 members of an Iraqi Special Forces unit. And Donald Rumsfeld announced the Pentagon will send up to 2,000 more troops to Iraq ahead of the October 15th referendum on the Constitution. In Africa, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is visiting Niger, where up to 5 million residents are facing severe food shortages.
I think it is important that we as an international community work with the government to deal with this emergency, not just in the short term, but work also on the longer term issues of food security to ensure that in another 5 or 3 years, we don't come back to the same problem.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan speaking in Niger. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders accuse the United Nations of being slow to react to the current epidemic of acute malnutrition in the country. Meanwhile, here in this country, 3 TV stations in Washington, D.C. are refusing to run an ad that criticizes the network's lack of coverage of the ongoing genocide in Sudan. The ad was created by the Center for American Progress for the campaign called Be a Witness. This is a clip of the ad.
While they show us this,
Michael Jackson's lawyers rested their case.
This
filed criminal charges against the so-called
runaway bride after faking her own abduction.
And this,
but some are wondering if the engagement of Tom Cruise
with actress Katie Holmes.
This is happening. You can't stop a genocide if you don't know about it. Genocide is news. Tell the media to be a witness.
Be a Witness campaign, an ad created by the Center for American Progress. Israel has announced the evacuation of settlers from the Gaza Strip and from 4 small West Bank settlements has been completed ahead of schedule. The army's estimating it evacuated 15,000 Israelis over the past week. 6,000 of them were non-residents who traveled to the settlements to protest the pullout. On Tuesday, 31 police officers and soldiers, as well as 11 civilians, were injured during the evacuation of 2 settlements in the West Bank. 10,000 troops from China and Russia are taking part in joint military exercises this week. The Chinese defense minister described the war games as a, quote, major historical event. The city of New York has signed a $200 million security contract with defense contractor Lockheed Martin to develop a high-tech surveillance system of the city's mass transit system. 1,000 cameras and 3,000 motion detectors will be installed on subways and other forms of mass transit. In medical news, researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, have issued a report determining that fetuses likely don't feel pain until the final months of pregnancy. Opponents of abortion rights have widely criticized the report. It's being issued at a time that anti-abortion advocates are pushing for fetal pain laws aimed at curtailing abortion. The Bush administration has proposed slightly increasing the fuel efficiency of minivans, pickups, and some SUVs over the next 5 years. Environmentalists have criticized the proposals because the rules will not apply to the biggest SUVs, such as the H2 Hummer. This comes as gas prices are reaching record high. Meanwhile, officials in 9 states have reached a preliminary agreement to freeze power plant emissions and to reduce them over the next 15 years. The decision came after the Bush administration decided not to regulate greenhouse gases. In news from Britain, the Sunday Mirror is reporting Prime Minister Tony Blair is expected to join the U.S.-based investment giant Carlyle Group after he leaves Downing Street. Nicknamed the Ex-President's Club, the investment firm already has on staff former President Bush, former British Prime Minister John Major, and former Secretary of State James Baker. And writer, radio host, and oral historian Studs Terkel is recovering at home after undergoing a risky open-heart surgery. Earlier this month, the 93-year-old Terkel underwent a 6-hour operation to replace a narrowed aortic valve and redo one of 5 coronary bypasses. Doctors say Terkel is the oldest patient known to have undergone such a procedure. Studs Terkel's surgeon said, quote, his progress is spectacular. He's recovering physically and mentally as well as someone half his age. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Christian televangelist Pat Robertson set off an international firestorm this week when he called for the assassination of Venezuela's democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez. Robertson made the comment on his TV program, The 700 Club.
He has destroyed the Venezuelan economy, and he's going to make that a launching pad for communist infiltration and Muslim extremism all over the continent. You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. And I don't think any oil shipments will stop, but this man is a terrific danger. This is in our sphere of influence, and we can't let this happen. We have the Monroe Doctrine. We have other doctrines that we have announced. And without question, this is a dangerous enemy to our South, controlling a huge pool of oil that could hurt us very badly. We have the ability to take him out, and I think the time has come that we exercise that ability. We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-arm dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Pat Robertson speaking on his TV show, The 700 Club. Robertson is 75 years old. He ran for president as a Republican in 1988. He's often used his show in the political advocacy group he founded, the Christian Coalition, to support President Bush. According to his website, the TV show, The 700 Club, has an audience of about 1 million people. At a news conference Tuesday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was questioned about Robertson's comments.
Reverend Pat Robertson has suggested that the United States should assassinate Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president. What were your reactions to those remarks, and has that ever been considered?
Not to my knowledge, I would think I would have knowledge. Certainly it's against the law. Our department doesn't do that type of thing. He's a private citizen. Private citizens say all kinds of things all the time.
Robertson's comments were also denounced by the State Department, which called them, quote, inappropriate. But the White House has remained silent despite repeated calls for repudiation. Meanwhile, the Reverend Jesse Jackson called for the Federal Communications Commission to investigate Robertson's comments. And the watchdog group Media Matters for America sent a letter urging the ABC Family Network to stop carrying his show. While some of Robertson's allies distanced themselves from his comments, other conservative Christian organizations were not so forthcoming. The president of the National Association of Evangelicals, the Reverend Ted Haggard, was questioned on CNN yesterday afternoon by Kara Phillips.
Well, I'm curious, is this religious leader, did he go a little too far here with his comments from a Christian perspective?
Well, from a Christian perspective, yes, but you've got to remember this is a political commentary portion of his show. It is his television show, and essentially what he's saying is that he's scared about some of the developments going on in that section of the world, and he wants them minimized. He wants them taken care of in the most efficient way that he can. So he's not speaking for evangelicalism. He's not speaking for Christians. He's just saying, from a political point of view and from a social point of view, somebody needs to contemplate how to minimize this so we don't end up in a full-scale war.
That was Reverend Ted Haggard, a National Association of Evangelicals, the president. Meanwhile, Robertson's comments have set off an international firestorm in Havana. Cuban President Fidel Castro criticized Robertson's comments, saying, quote, I think only God can punish crimes of such magnitude. Meanwhile, Venezuela's ambassador to Washington, Bernardo Alvarez, said Bush needs to guarantee Chavez's safety at the next month's UN meeting in New York.
We are very disappointed with Pat Roberts' statement over the Christian Broadcast Network. Mr. Robertson is, of course, no ordinary private citizen. He was a candidate for the GPO's presidential nomination in 1992. The organization that Mr. Robertson leads, the Christian Coalition, claims nearly 2 million members and has a multi-million dollar a year budget. In 2000, it was credited with helping George W. Bush win the important South Carolina primary and catapulting him to the nomination of his party for president. Mr. Robertson has been one of this president's staunchest allies. His statement demands the strongest condemnation by the White House. Mr. Robertson calls that U.S. government cover operative murder President Hugo Chavez is a call to terrorism. He called that President Chavez violently imposed the outdated Monroe doctrines on Venezuela is a call for the American intervention in the sovereign affairs of our democratic country. The United States might not permit its citizens to use its territory and airwaves to incite terrorists abroad and the murder of a democratically elected president. Venezuela demands that the U.S. abide by international and domestic law and respect our country and its president. Pat Robertson's statement must be condemned in the strongest term by the Bush administration, and we are concerned about the safety of our president. It is essential that the U.S. government guarantees his safety when he visits this country in the future, including his scheduled visit to the United Nations in New York. From the messages we have received, it is clear that Pat Robertson does not speak for Christians in the U.S., nor even for the Christian coalition, when he calls for the assassination of our president. We think that
Venezuela's ambassador to the U.S., Bernardo Alvarez, speaking at a news conference on Tuesday. In Caracas, Vice President Jose Vicente Rangel said Venezuela was studying its legal options in response to the comments. He said, quote, "It's huge hypocrisy to maintain this discourse against terrorism. And at the same time, in the heart of that country, there are entirely terrorist statements like those." Chavez has often accused the United States of plotting his overthrow or assassination. He survived an aborted coup attempt in 2002. U.S. involvement? Well, over the years, tens of millions of dollars in U.S. government money has been given to Venezuelan opposition groups through the National Endowment for Democracy. Last August, President Chavez survived a referendum to remove him from power through a recall election. Venezuela is the world's fifth largest oil exporting country and a major supplier to the United States. We're joined today by Chris Hedges, a journalist and author, foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 15 years. Currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He's author of a number of books. His latest is Losing Moses on the Freeway. He has a master's degree in theology from Harvard University and is currently writing a book on the Christian right. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk about who Pat Robertson is, and is this statement unusual for him?
Well, this fits a pattern of essentially seditious statements that have been made by Pat Robertson since the early 1980s, when he embraced this new doctrine within the Christian right, known as Christian Reconstructionism or Dominionism. That's not a term that he would use to describe it, but that's how shorthand for those of us who look at it from the outside, where he calls for the creation of a Christian America, a Christian state. There has been an assault against the democratic system, largely unseen, I think, by the majority of the American people ever since the early 1980s. The empire that Robertson and the other radical Christian right evangelicals have amassed, the media empire, is now huge. What began as a relatively small operation, basically a radio operation, now sees just Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network alone employing over 1,000 people. They have facilities in three U.S. cities, as well as the Ukraine, Philippines, India, and Israel. And this is part of a large empire where radical Christians now control six national television networks, each reaching tens of millions of homes, and virtually all of the nation's 2,000 religious radio stations. Christian radio now outnumbers every other format except country music and news talk. And the latest venture is putting up direct broadcast satellite networks such as Sky Angels that carries, Sky Angel carries 36 channels of Christian radio and TV and nothing else. So when Pat Robertson makes this kind of a statement, is being pumped into the homes on an alternative information network to tens of millions of Americans who rely on these radical religious right figures
for their news, for their entertainment, for their commentary, and for what is purportedly their version of the Bible, which for those of us who come out of the church and come out of seminary, in my case, is deeply distorted and perverted. I have not memorized Pat Robertson quotes, but I went and collected a few. But let me just read one that goes back to 1981, where he said, "The Constitution of the United States, for instance, is a marvelous document for self-government by the Christian people. But the minute you turn the document into the hands of non-Christian people and atheistic people, they can use it to destroy the very foundation of our society." This sets the tone for essentially a politically charged movement that seeks to dismantle our open society.
Chris Hedges, former New York Times correspondent, author of the book Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. And we'll come back with him. We'll also be joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and look at the implications of this call for the assassination of a foreign leader. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quebra ley.
Mano Chao here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Democracy Now! Is broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And yes, we're podcasting, or video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Our headlines are in Spanish, and all programs are in transcript as well as video audio at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion of the comments of Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who's just gone to Cuba and has met with the Cuban President Fidel Castro, our guests are Chris Hedges. He's a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, author of a number of books, among them What Every Person Should Know About War and Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. We're also joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Before we go to Michael, Chris, some other quotes of Pat Robertson's.
Well, I think it's important to understand the ideology that comes into play with these kinds of statements. Robertson, along with most of the radical Christian right, endorses violence as a kind of curative for the satanic movement, secular humanism, liberalism, Islam, whatever it is that they see outside the gate. So the final aesthetic of their movement, in many ways, is violence. This is what the whole End Times series is about. So if you go back and look at his statements, he repeatedly sees incredibly destructive and violent acts as the hand of God. His most famous statement coming along with Jerry Falwell right after 9/11, when he said that the attacks of 9/11 were caused by pagans, abortionists, feminists, gays, lesbians, the ACLU, and People for the American Way. He often makes predictions. He, of course, claims that God speaks to him for the new year, he has, in the past, claimed to have, through God's power, harnessed the destructive might of hurricanes, such as Hurricane Gloria in 1985, where he claim that through his relationship with God, he steered the hurricane away from his company's Virginia Beach headquarters. This hurricane, of course, caused millions of dollars of destruction in states along the East Coast. He made a similar claim about Hurricane Felix in 1995. But what we're seeing is not a kook. What we're seeing is somebody who has this messianic belief that violence and destruction is being carried out against non-believers, against those who do not endorse his radical ideology, and that he is a kind of player along with God in that destructive force.
Hasn't he also called for the destruction of the State Department?
Yes, he indicated that that an explosion of a nuclear weapon at the State Department could be good for the country. The direct quote is, "I think the best country." Well, that's not the nuclear. This is when he was asked a question about it, and he said that a small nuclear device would be good for the country if it exploded in the State Department.
Michael Ratner, this latest comment of Pat Robertson talking about the assassination of Hugo Chavez, calling for it. What are the legal implications of this?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand that this comment came out of a context, in which in 2002, many people believe the U.S., and there's evidence of it, was very involved in the coup to overthrow Chavez. And a recent trip of Rumsfeld to the region, in which he basically said the real dangers here are Chavez and Fidel Castro, and they're implementing work in Bolivia against the government, et cetera. So all of a sudden, then you get Robertson saying this, and you question, well, is this all working together? Is Robertson really sowing the seeds in this country, making fertile ground among the millions that Chris has referred to make them ready and able to accept an overthrow or an assassination of Chavez. Now, legally, there's two ways to look at it. It is prohibited for the United States or U.S. officials to assassinate the head of state or really any official overseas. That's been in place since the 70s, since the U.S. tried to assassinate, as many people, as listeners know, everybody from did assassinate Diem in Vietnam, tried to assassinate Fidel Castro in Cuba, did attempted assassinations in Chile in the early 70s, et cetera. So that prohibition was put in place. It doesn't mean that the U.S. has ever adhered to that, and we've had recent examples where President Bush called for Osama bin Laden dead or alive, or when they actually purposely targeted Saddam Hussein's various places where they thought he was living in an attempt to essentially assassinate him. So from a U.S. perspective, it's supposed to be outlawed, but let me tell you, you can't believe a word that Rumsfeld is saying when you see him on TV there saying this is against the law in the United States. Yes, it's against the law, but you can't believe that these guys don't have that in their brain as to what they're thinking. Now, in the U.S., of course, we have very broad protections for First Amendment right to advocate all kinds of things. You get in trouble when you advocate something that is likely to happen imminently or soon. So I can't go in front of a mob and say, there's that guy over there, let's go lynch him, and everybody's carrying these sticks and everybody goes over there. Then I can be guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, attempted murder, whatever various laws you can. Robertson's quote arguably falls within the line that says, you know, you can advocate this and therefore it wouldn't be illegal. But I can tell you, if there were other people in this country doing similar kinds of things, if someone advocated an Islamic cleric, for example, in the same level as Robertson, the murder or assassination of Tony Blair in the United Kingdom because of the Iraq War, I can tell you that cleric would be in jail in this country, and they would figure out a way to make the law say that, well, his followers were imminently going to do something about it, and advocating it helped him. Or if someone during the anti-apartheid period said, let's kill the president of South Africa who's supporting anti-apartheid. Supporting apartheid. I can tell you those people would likely be in jail. If they were non-citizens, they'd be jailed and deported very quickly.
Samuel Arian, the Florida professor who they say advocated violence, is currently in jail. Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, the government is current. Continually said he called for the overthrow or assassination of Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president.
Right, particularly with non-citizens, the line that I gave you is very different. Non-citizens advocating assassinations, violence, can be jailed under various terrorist laws. They can be deported, etc. And of course, as we know now, Britain is now conceiving of a certain a wide set of laws, particularly aimed at non-citizens, for advocating any kind of violence. That those laws under Britain would have put Robertson in jail.
Do you think Robertson should be in jail?
Well, do I think he should be in jail? I mean, I think people should be tried for crimes and jailed if it's found to be the case. What I think is happening here, though, is Robertson really, in a broad way, if not a literal conspiracy with officials of this government and other people in the United States, to essentially sow the ground for the eventual overthrow of Chavez.
Again, among Robertson's comments, if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, talking about Hugo Chavez, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war, and I don't think any oil shipments will stop, he said. Chris Hedges, let's look back at the history of Pat Robertson. Now, you've been a foreign correspondent for the New York Times for many years. You're now a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. You worked in Central America in the early 80s. Can you talk about that period?
Robertson, you know, has latched on to very despotic movements. You know, he was very close to Charles Taylor, for instance. He had invested in Liberia, invested $8 million in a Liberian gold mine. He has, you know, we don't know exactly how much he's worth. Estimates range anywhere from $200 million to $1 billion, certainly an extremely wealthy figure. And he has set up alliances with some of the most despotic regimes around the globe, including a very deep involvement in the forces of extremism in Central America. He was an avid supporter of the Contras in the war against set up by the Reagan administration against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, a strong supporter of Rios Montt, who carried out wholesale massacres in Guatemala in the early 1980s, and the regime in El Salvador during the war at a time when the death squads in El Salvador were killing between 800 and 1,000 people a month. And this was not limited to statements of support from the United States, but visits. And I actually covered visits by Robertson and Falwell to embrace these movements. I think that what makes this particularly dangerous is that it's not just a very radical right-wing agenda, but a kind of sanctification of violence, a belief that violence, and this is, you know, the language that they use, can be used to defeat the forces of Satan. And believe me, people like Pat Robertson don't see boundaries. Satan's influence for people like Robertson or Falwell is as pervasive, in some ways more so, within American society just as it is without. So that when I hear them call for the assassination of a head of state in Latin America, when I see him embrace people like Charles Taylor, those running the death squads in El Salvador, the Contras, Rios Montt, I think we have to understand that this ideology is one that is also going to come into play within our own country. And the notion that somehow it's going to be limited, this kind of call for violence is going to be limited to simply those who he perceives as arrayed against us outside our own borders is naive. What we're talking about is a movement, that a very, very increasingly powerful movement that endorses violence as a way to create what they term the Christian society or the Christian nation. And that endorsement of violence, while they're certainly very clever and careful, is one that is not going to be limited to non-Americans.
Chris Hedges, a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. His latest book is Losing Moses on the Freeway. Do you think, I'll ask both of you this question, Michael Ratner and Chris Hedges, that the fact that Chavez was going to Cuba was significant here, with the U.S. trying to up the ante against Fidel Castro as well, talking about his overthrow or destabilizing the government?
Well, I think this is Chavez's fourth trip to Cuba. The U.S. is obviously incredibly concerned about Chavez's relationship to Cuba. He sells oil to Cuba. He's trying to form sort of a Bolivarian group in Latin America that will oppose U.S. hegemony in the region. He's not about to turn his oil resources over to the United States. So I think this is all part of it. That it happened while he was in Cuba, I think, is significant and makes you wonder to what extent was there some kind of connection with some kind of U.S. officials over this statement, whether at the highest level or at the middle level.
And what does Cuba represent to Pat Robertson, Chris Hedges?
Well, you heard it in the rhetoric. I mean, you know, remember that these people, they always need to set up a dark satanic force that they're battling against. That used to be Marxism and communism. You know, although the insurgencies I covered in Central America had nothing to do with Marxism, in essence. And now that's been replaced by terrorism and Islam. So, you know, we have this absolutely convoluted statement that we have to fight the president of Venezuela because we're fighting Muslim extremists. And I think that what it has to do with is that bifurcation of the world into the forces of darkness and the forces of light, and all of the forces of darkness are lumped together, even if there's a tremendous incongruity between the head of a state of a Latin American country and a follower of Osama bin Laden.
Michael Ratner, you've written books on the U.S. and Cuba, and you talk about, you know, of course, the attempted assassination of Castro. But when you say, of course, a lot of young people particularly don't understand the level. You have the latest head of the U.S. interest section in Havana actually basically promising Castro would be taken out. What is this history?
Well, it's been 40 years. I mean, since 1959 or shortly thereafter, the U.S. has embargoed Cuba, attempted to overthrow Castro, sent in terrorists to maim and kill people in Cuba. I mean, as we know.
How many assassination attempts against Castro
himself? Oh, I don't know. There's scores of them, I'm sure. Everything from exploding cigars to, you know, all kinds of things that we make fun of, but were actually really, really serious. So it's been a history of U.S. terrorism against Cuba, attempts against Castro's life. And now he's survived some 40 years, and now they're saying it again. So are they serious again about it? Well, these guys, you have to take them seriously when they make these kind of statements about wanting to take people out. So remarkable.
It's interesting. While President Bush did talk to reporters yesterday, it seems like he has taken a break from his break now at Crawford and gone to Idaho because of the protests. You have these reporters who are just sitting there baking in the hot sun with nothing to do, and except to interview the people who are protesting, like Cindy Sheehan outside. And so President Bush knows he's got an obliging press. He goes to Idaho, the press follows, and he can take them away from interviewing these protesters. But he was talking to reporters, talking about Cindy Sheehan, but not talking about the comment of Pat Robertson. What about the relationship between Pat Robertson and President Bush? And also the way Pat Robertson is treated by the press. When he goes on different programs to comment on different issues, he's very much treated as a kind of older statesman. And these quotes are not raised, at least in the past.
Well, I think that's a really important point. I think the, you know, as somebody who spent most of their career in the mainstream media, I think the problem is that the mainstream media is mystified and doesn't understand who these people are. They are willing to give them a kind of religious legitimacy that they should not have. That's, I think, largely because the mainstream media itself is secular and uncomfortable with religiosity. I think that what we're seeing is essentially an attempt at appeasement, an attempt to include these radical figures within the mainstream in the hope that they will be domesticated. This, you know, having watched this process around the globe, including in places like Yugoslavia, it's a disastrous mistake because these people are very clear and quite upfront, and, you know, everyone should listen to their broadcasts. They're very open about what they want to do to this country and what they want to create. And there is no place in their vision of America for people like you and me.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said yesterday that he was offering to help needy Americans with cheap supplies of gasoline. He said, quote, "We want to sell gasoline and heating fuel directly to poor communities in the United States." He didn't say how Venezuela would go about providing gas to these poor communities, but the Venezuelan state oil company owns Citgo, which operates 14,000 gas stations here. Chavez said Venezuela would supply gasoline to Americans at half the price they now pay if intermediaries who speculated and exploited consumers were cut out. What about the politics of oil and Chavez, former head of OPEC, extremely significant now with gas prices at their highest in many years?
Well, it seems obvious. I mean, that the U.S., you know, not only what we've been saying about Latin America and the shifts in Latin America going toward a more, many governments moving in a more progressive way, the tumult in Latin America, but, you know, Venezuela is the fourth biggest oil supplier to the United States. It controls a huge amount of reserves. It's dealing with Cuba right now. And the U.S., I remember back in the Grenada days, when we went after Grenada, they talked about, like, the shipping lanes for oil, you know, in the Caribbean, and they went after Grenada on that. So I think you have to look at this as part of the Latin American movement toward a more progressive governments, but part of it, obviously, about oil.
We're going to talk about hybrid cars and alternative energy and the use of gas in this country in a minute. But I just wanted to end by asking about this comment of the Venezuelan ambassador to the United States being concerned in if and when Hugo Chavez comes to New York for the United Nations General Assembly meetings in September, as so many heads of state do from around the world, what this means for him. Will Pat Robertson be detained during that time because he presents a danger to a foreign president?
Well, you know, this is we should not underestimate the seriousness of what Robertson did. I mean, what we have here is a man with millions of adherents around the world, in this country, possibly in Venezuela and other places. And when that person says it's good to take somebody out, it's good to assassinate him, what is he saying to his adherents except go for this guy? So when Chavez is in Venezuela, there may be some guys there. When he comes to the U.S., obviously this is the heart and core of Robertson's support, and is that statement, are his strong statements about what this guy represents going to cause somebody to do something? So they have asked for real protection if and when Chavez comes here.
And I think we have to remember that the radical fringe of this movement is violent, that those who attack abortion clinics, those who embrace this creed and are members of militia movements are people who not only believe in the use of violence but practice the use of violence. So what you have potentially is the incitement of these fringe groups within the movements who are happy and willing to use force.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Chris Hedges, former correspondent for the New York Times, a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, has written a number of books, including Wars of Force, that gives us meaning, what every person should know about war, and most recently, Losing Moses on the Freeway, the Ten Commandments in America. He is currently writing a book on the Christian right. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the future of fossil fuel-based transportation in the U.S., gasoline prices continue to hit record highs this week, reaching above $2.60 per gallon, $65 a barrel. According to the Washington Post last week, the biggest one-week jump in the average price of a gallon of gas occurred since the Energy Department began compiling the data 15 years ago. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration proposed new fuel efficiency standards Tuesday. The updated standards would change the way compliance is measured, starting with some SUVs and trucks built in 2008. So-called light trucks would be required to increase their fuel efficiency by 1.8 miles per gallon over 4 years. President Bush's Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta, announced the proposal in front of a Los Angeles gas station.
Our plan will require light trucks to be more fuel efficient, regardless of size. Now, this plan is good news for American consumers because it will ensure that the vehicles that they will buy get more miles to the gallon and ultimately save them money.
Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. Environmental groups criticized the proposal for failing to reduce U.S. dependence on foreign oil and for opening up new loopholes for car companies to get around fuel efficiency standards. Well, we're going to go right now to a person who has been talking about fuel efficiency for quite some time. Brad Berman is in the studio with us. He is editor of HybridCars.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. First, respond to Mineta's statement and what this means.
Well, I think the key thing to look at are the numbers. And to suggest that the big goal is to reach 23.5 miles a gallon by 2010 for light trucks is not to close an SUV loophole. And in addition, the way that they've structured it and the complexity of it creates more loopholes. The fact is that approximately 50% of the cars on the road today are these light-duty trucks because of the popularity of SUVs, and to not require them to reach certain levels of fuel efficiency and high levels of fuel efficiency that are possible is just to procrastinate when we've already been procrastinating for 30 years.
Okay. How much gas, miles per gallon, do these cars get, basically?
You know, it depends. If you look at the big monster SUVs, which are not even like the Hummers, are not even included in this at all.
Why can they exclude them?
I think the original thinking was that they were business related. When these laws were initially put in, the idea was that if you need a truck for your business, then in order to keep the wheels in motion for business to do its work, then we don't have to require these big hauling trucks to follow in line. But with the popularity of SUVs and the fact that they're called light duty trucks, even though they're being used to go to the grocery store, is the result of
and their fuel efficiency or inefficiency?
I mean, it depends. I mean, they can go down to single digits, you know, or maybe more commonly 13 or 14 miles to the gallon.
Hybrid cars. First of all, a lot of people won't even know what we're referring to, but you are a specialist in this area. What are they?
Well, we currently have 8 hybrid gas electric vehicles on the market today. And it's essentially a technology innovation, which means that we're moving away from strictly using a gasoline internal combustion engine to combining the gas engine with an electric motor and electric batteries. So you don't need to plug them in. The electric batteries, the hybrid batteries, recharge themselves, and the car uses sophisticated computer technology to decide, okay, I need to go faster or I'm slowing down. When do I use the batteries or the electric side, and when do I use the gas? And as a result, commonly you can double the fuel economy of your car.
What's the average miles per gallon?
Well, if you look at the smaller hybrid cars like the Toyota Prius, the Honda Civic Hybrid, or the Honda Insight, the Toyota Prius, you're talking in real world conditions about 50 miles to the gallon. Honda Insight, which is just a 2-seater car, is closer to 60, and the Civic Hybrid, which I drive, is in the mid 40s.
Hmm. Well, I was at Soulfest this weekend in Northern California, which is an annual festival in Hopland that showcases sustainable energy solutions. And I went over to the area where people were promoting hybrid cars. Let's just listen and watch.
Hi, my name is Ty Robinson from Intergalactic Hydrogen. Our company supports all fuel types, and we believe in a distributed approach to fuels. This is a multi-fuel vehicle. It can run on hydrogen or natural gas or ethanol, and it still retains its ability to use gasoline. It's an historic vehicle, gold medal winning. We won a gold medal at the Michelin Challenge Bibendum with this vehicle for emissions. This is the first vehicle to cross the country using compressed hydrogen for fuel. We led Dennis Weaver's Drive to Survive from Santa Monica to Washington, D.C. It also has an altitude record for driving on hydrogen at 13,114 feet over Imogene Pass. Basically, this vehicle saves me a lot of money because hydrogen is available today at half the cost of gasoline. My favorite place to fill up is in Phoenix, Arizona at APS, Arizona Public Service, where they make what I call free-range hydrogen. They make hydrogen from the electrolysis of water using solar panels. So this is a renewable form of hydrogen that we can make again and again, and it's an endless supply because we put electricity in the water to make hydrogen and oxygen. When we burn the hydrogen with oxygen in the engine, it makes water out the tailpipe, and so we make purified water again, and it's half the cost of gasoline. That's the second most used fuel I use in this vehicle, though. The primary fuel I use for transportation, because this is my daily driver, it's got over 140,000 miles on it, I use methane or natural gas. Where I live in Utah, it's available for $1 a gallon. So that's cut my fuel cost by two-thirds. I'm saving a lot of money with natural gas, and natural gas even cleans the air on an inversion day in Salt Lake or any time down in L.A. The air coming out the tailpipe is cleaner than the air coming in the air filter. So that's a pretty good deal. Save money, clean the air, support our economy, and boy, probably help our nation's security at the same time. Then I use ethanol as a last resort to gasoline, and the ethanol I get comes from corn-based, so supporting our American farmers. The ethanol is available predominantly for less than the cost of gasoline, so that's, again, a great deal. This year, so far, I have had to buy 13 gallons of gasoline, but I made a point to buy American-sourced petroleum gasoline. I actually bought it from Sinclair, so it comes from Wyoming. So that's why I call this an American fuel vehicle. A lot of people call these alternative fuel vehicles or AFVs, and I figure if we're going to make this go mainstream, then we can't keep calling it the alternative. So we can keep the AFV initials, but we got to call these American fuel vehicles here.
Where do people get cars like this?
Well, you know, these vehicles should be rolling off the assembly line in numbers, because if they were, it wouldn't cost any difference in building the vehicle to run on gasoline. But right now, they're being built one at a time at our shop. We can build a natural gas vehicle for just about anybody. Take any vehicle, make it run on natural gas, and start saving you money immediately. We can also build hydrogen vehicles for people. Building them one at a time, though, isn't economical. So that's for the rock stars and the movie stars, people that want to promote their green side and do a good thing for themselves, for the health of people, as well as for the environment.
Brad Berman, your comment.
Well, he was speaking about a lot of different choices for how we're going to fuel our cars, and that's great. We should be looking to all kinds of different options. I think the distinction between what he was speaking about and hybrid gas electric vehicles are that hybrids are being sold. This year we'll have over 200,000 sold in the United States. So we can continue to try to innovate and think about new ways to change our automotive technology, but the key thing is for people right now, they can make a decision, they can go to a local dealership, they can check out things on hybridcars.com, and they can be in a hybrid car in the next couple of days.
People may say, okay, 40, 50, 60, that's pretty astounding, but the cost of these vehicles will, in the end, balance that savings out on the road, and not maybe environmentally, but certainly price-wise.
Right. If you look at it in pure dollars and cents, the argument is commonly made in the mainstream media that hybrids don't pay off, you don't get a payback period. Even if you disregard the fact that people don't really buy cars that way and you just look at the equation, I think as a result of rising gas prices, strong resale values for these cars, tax credits which go in January 1st that will greatly increase the tax incentive, all and savings at the pumps all add up to a good deal. I mean, you're gonna not only save money, but you're doing it for many other reasons, obviously, such as energy security and the environment. But all of it adds up to essentially a no-brainer from my point of view.
Brad Berman, why haven't hybrid cars been more developed in this country? Can you talk about the history of them?
Sure. Well, you know, at the turn of the century, I don't want to go back too far, but at the turn of the century, we had gasoline engines like we have now. We had electric cars and we had steamers, and people preferred electric cars. It wasn't until Ford came along with some innovations like the electric starter that it completely wiped out all those choices. As the clip pointed out, we're now at the point again where there are a lot of choices. You can carry it straight through to the 1960s. Where backyard tinkerers started looking at electric vehicles again, especially as a result of environmental concerns, and as you move into the 70s, concerns with related around oil. So the main factor is that the car makers haven't, especially Detroit car makers, have not jumped forward with this. I mean, the technology's there. It has been there for 30 years. And the constant excuse is that the American public cares more about speed and performance than they care about fuel economy. In the last couple of years, with the innovation with hybrids, that's completely changed, and people are caring a lot more about fuel economy.
What role does the government play? And did the government play a role in suppressing the development of hybrid cars?
I think it was more total disregard and looking at pie in the sky plans such as hydrogen, which we're probably still a decade or two away from any kind of viable hydrogen vehicle. So it's more not making it an imperative that we increase fuel efficiency. I mean, that's the great unfinished business.
The current energy bill, what does it do? That was just signed, the Energy Act of 2005.
It does increase the federal tax incentive on hybrid cars from a current deduction, which is a reduction of taxable income of $2,000, which is worth about $300 to $500 in people's pockets, to a full-out tax credit with a sliding scale, meaning that a Toyota Prius, you can take as much as about $3,000 directly off of your taxes. So that's part of the equation why it makes sense starting in January 1st. But, you know, again, this is a little bit of window dressing. I mean, the point is, unless we increase fuel efficiency standards or increase gas taxes, I mean, that's a taboo that nobody will touch, but if we increase gas taxes like they have higher gas taxes in Europe and use the proceeds from that to invest in alternative vehicle technology, then we start to have a solution.
Do you plug in your car?
No, you do not need to plug the cars in. I mean, the innovation with hybrid cars is that it's the first, quote-unquote, alternative technology that requires no special usage. You don't have to do anything differently.
It just itself shifts from electric to gas back and forth.
It does it all by itself. You get in the car, you turn the key, you go. You don't have to do anything special. And that's why it's being adopted by larger and larger numbers of people throughout the country.
We just have a few seconds, and I wanted to ask, with our latest discussion about Pat Robertson talking about the assassination of Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, big oil supplier, on the blogs around hybrid cars and energy, has there been discussion about this?
Yes. We have a very active set of group of bloggers on hybridcars.com, and people have commented about Pat Robertson and Hugo Chavez. The fact is that all the government incentives won't have as much of an effect as rising gas prices or insecurity in the gas market. And if something happens with Victor Chavez, it's going to disrupt our oil supply. The prices are going to go way up. People are going to be lining up at the pumps, and people are going to be wanting hybrid cars even more.
Brad Berman, thanks for joining us. Editor of HybridCars.com. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser, Susie Salami. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.